Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Zeke. I'm here with Jen. I'm here with Bettina. It's Movement Museum, where we talk about dance on your radio. It's 205 CKUT 90.3 FM on your radio dial. Movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer. If you want to email us, movement@ckut.ca. And before my mouth runs away with me, let me run into this poem, which is called Dancer, How Do You Dare? It's by Norma Farber. Dancer, how do you rise? The ground sends me. Grace suspends me. Gravity lands me. Dancer, how do you leap? The ground spurns me. Grace contains me. Gravity returns me. Dancer, how do you dance? The ground allows me. Grace endows me. Gravity bows me. Yeah, it was one that I picked because nice. We have another fancy, impressive, really superstar, amazing person in studio with us that we're going to talk with. His name is Bradley Michaud. Did I get that right?
That's right, yes.
For somebody from L.A., how do you have a French name? How did you luck into it?
Well, it's kind of strange. My family is actually Italian. Someone got in there along the way with a French last name. So it's Michaud, but I went through most of my childhood with my child in Macad. So Italian, French, and Irish.
That's not a bad combination.
I don't think so.
Typically American, I find.
Yeah, a mutt.
And so, yeah, as we should step back slightly, you run Method Dance, the Method Dance Company. Did I get it right?
We call it Method Contemporary Dance.
Okay. And they're out of L.A., and you've been doing that for how long?
We're starting our sixth season this season.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
And,
I can't believe it.
Yeah, there it's, as we said off air, and by the way, Jen and Bettina, jump in at any time. I don't have to talk all this much. But, you wrote at the, because you're doing master classes at Sacriès, and you've been doing that for about 2 weeks now, which is how we lucked into getting you, roped you into the studio. But you have written that you don't like talking about dance, and so, yeah, sorry about it, but that's the only thing we can do right here.
I know, I was thinking about that. I wish I could dance in the studio and just have that somehow be conveyed. You could interpret for me while I'm dancing.
Well, you seem to be a bit of a purist.
I am, yeah.
So it says right up front on your statement that there's no theater, there's no multimedia, no gimmicks. You're just bare to the bones, pure dance.
Right, and I guess it comes across as kind of elitist to talk or express that view, but I don't like those other things. It's not that I don't like viewing them, but I don't... like doing them. I'm not a video editor or a poet, so I don't put spoken word or multimedia in my dances because I haven't spent my life dedicated to that. I've spent my life dedicated to dance, so I just want to do that. And there's a big push in the United States away from that. It has to be cross cultural, collaborative. There must be right. something else in there. And I really, over the last decade, have really rejected that completely.
That's really interesting because we had George Stamos in here last time, and he's like all over the multimedia and, mm-hmm. and sound and everything. So it's very interesting to have you in as a counterpoint. So basically, you don't feel that you want to be influenced or at all, or work with people who are, maybe sort of get the team together of other artists.
Well, I do have a little team of artists. I mean, I consider my dancers part of my team, right. a lighting designer. Mm-hmm. That's about it. I don't even like costumes.
That's right. So you're very pure also on the costumes.
We pretty much wear tank tops and 3/4 pants in every show. Some variation mm-hmm. of that. I feel like the message I want to convey needs to be conveyed through the choreography. Mm-hmm. And I guess, again, this is where the elitist part comes in. If I'm focused on costumes or even music, I'm using that to express what I should be expressing through the choreography. I mean, there's pieces I've made where there's no music, it's just us dancing.
Wow. I think that's a very excellent, interesting view.
Thank you.
I
like it.
And increasingly rare.
I quite like it as well.
It's very rare. I mean, I spent most of my college years being told, why don't you put a Robert Frost poem in here? Or, why don't you add something else? And I just didn't feel the need to do that, and I, felt bad about it a lot of the time. It wasn't until I got into a dance company in LA called Tongue with Stephanie Gilliland, who was the artistic director, who really embraces this type of philosophy as well, that I kind of felt at home and felt that I finally found the answer that my body had been asking, the question my body had been asking my whole life. Why can't dance just be enough? Why do I have to put all these other things in it? I don't think we ask that of other art forms, really. I think in a way, I mean, I never go to a museum and look at a painting and think, wow, I wish there were dancers here to help me explain this painting. But I feel like we ask that of dancers. Just having dance on stage isn't enough. There must be a sculptural element or program notes that are highly detailed to help explain what's going on.
Or the talk after the dance.
Right, or a Q&A, which I never do.
So the work speaks for itself.
I hope so.
So I just wanted to ask, just because music and dance has always been so deeply integrated. Mm-hmm. When you do use music, how do you approach that? How do you integrate that? What kind of music do you use? Do you work, with like someone who creates the music for you, or?
It varies. Sometimes I find a piece of music that just inspires me, and I'll usually re-edit it mm-hmm. on my computer without permission, and expand it. Sometimes I've made music myself. Mm-hmm. It happens different every time, but I never really start from a musical place. I always start from a movement place, and if I find music that matches or that goes with it or further inspires me, then I will add it. But otherwise, I just don't find it necessary.
Mm-hmm. So you start with a concept?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. So you start with an idea?
Yeah, and I never know when that's going to come or how or why. So sometimes it can be very frustrating. I either start by thinking, here's a dance I want to make, here's an event that happened to me and I want to make something about this, or I just get in the studio and start screwing around with my dancers and just kind of see what develops and evolves, and that's how it starts.
Yeah, but I like how you describe it as sort of that immediate moment after tripping.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of that sort of loss of sort of the breaking down that sort of wall of artifice.
Well, that's kind of my general philosophy, because the reason why I didn't like to talk about dance, my dance, was because I didn't really know how to express it, and I was finally forced to do it in a blog for a company that I worked with last year. And I like when people fall down, but I don't like when people trip. Like when you see someone walking on the sidewalk, coffee in hand, all put together, they have their facade on, they're out looking great, feeling good, and they trip over like a crack in the sidewalk. I don't like the moment when they trip, and I don't like the recovery afterwards. I like the moment when their autonomic nervous system takes over and they throw the papers and, they freak out for that second and their real you kind of pokes through, their inner animal kind of takes over from, and pushes the facade away. I like that moment.
Interesting. Have you noticed that after people trip, they always laugh?
Mm-hmm.
They always laugh at themselves and they kind of look around and everybody kind of laughs with them. It's like for a moment, they stop being so serious.
Yeah. And I think they're a little embarrassed that a real them kind of poked through. Mm. That, or if you get scared and then you laugh, same kind of type of thing. So I try to like extend that moment or find that moment in my dancers. So we'll work over and over again with a small movement, making it bigger and bigger and bigger until they scare themselves or I get scared for them. And then that's where we start. Oh, and we build off that.
How much does it hurt?
Surprisingly, not that much. I mean, it does hurt. We're, you know, athletes and we get injured. I'm covered with bruises right now and I feel like I want to cut my feet off.
You just got to love the floor too, hey?
Yeah, you just have to love being down there and being sore. But we have a surprisingly low injury rate in my company and with my classes because I spend a lot of, we work very slow and I really, really focus on proper mechanics and skeletal alignment and really using your muscles. And a lot of dancers don't really have strong arms or strong cores, surprisingly, I find. And so I really push that. And once you have those things, you know, proper skeletal alignment and really good connection to your muscularity, you know how to get into the floor and get out of it, and you don't really get injured. I mean, the most serious injury I've ever had was I dislocated a rib. That was a huge mistake I made, landing on someone the wrong way.
Ooh. I've never heard of a dislocated rib.
I didn't know you could do that either. And I went to the doctor, and he goes, oh, you dislocated. I go, I don't think that's possible. He goes, it is, because you have it.
And you popped it back in?
Yeah, I went to a chiropractor, and he reached underneath my rib cage and pushed it back up.
That hurts, even just hearing it.
Yeah.
One thing in seeing the various videos that are out there of your dances and so on, one theory that I've been trying to work is how MMA and the various martial arts actually work into the whole dancing, because this whole combination of stuff where it used to be, you had ballet, you had contemporary dance, then you had other stuff that wasn't dance, and now it's all coming together into some sort of hodgepodge. I'm waiting to find out what squirts out in about 5-10 years. Do you have are influenced by martial arts in any way? Do you see that sort of coming into the dance, or am I just out to lunch?
No, you're not out to lunch. I don't really get inspired by that, but pretty much everyone who's seen my work has said, oh, it's very much like martial arts. The very first piece I did was called After the Fracture. It was two guys, and it was like a 7 minutes, no music, and we were just pummeling each other. I mean, it was choreographed. But everyone said, wow, that was really aggressive, and it was like MMA. They had mentioned that. It was called something else back in the day.
Ultimate Fighting?
Yes. They were like, that's very Ultimate Fighting. And I think a lot of things look like other things just because there's only so many ways you can move your body. But I do think there is a push within the dance world right now to get away from the lines of ballet. And there always is this push. Every like decade or so it comes around, we need to try something completely different. Whether it's pouring water from one cup to another for an hour or, you know, something really postmodern. But I think at least in Los Angeles, there's this push right now to kind of go back to extreme hyper-physical idiosyncratic movement. And it just so happens that a lot of that stuff resembles wrestling.
That's also that sort of space between sort of where you trip and before you catch yourself. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that when you're in competition and you're sort of fighting, it's that same sort of whatever that part of the brain is that's at the base of the neck. That sort of says, I don't know my biology or my anatomy that well, but where you just sort of, that automatic reaction, that's where you, and I was thinking, but never mind.
No, I know.
I'm having difficulty getting the words out of my mouth because that part of the brain is taking over.
Well, when you said that, I thought of like tennis players who just die for the ball, even though they know they're going to be landing on a hard surface, or MMA fighters who just pick someone up and they both fall together in this off-center place. I think those are very exciting for people to watch because no one ever goes in that space. You exist either horizontally or standing straight up. You never exist in this other space. And with my work, I try to stay in that other space for as long as possible.
Oh, okay. Now seeing you move your arm from the horizontal to the vertical and sort of then what going in between the 90 and the zero, I said, oh, that now makes perfect sense. Now I understand.
Mm-hmm. I like to be in that area.
Okay.
Being completely off center. So it's that moment after the trip I was talking about earlier, but just extending it for as long as possible and seeing what kind of ride can exist there. There's a big thing in the dance world, you know, of course, about the ride of the pelvis and the head and how those relate, but I like to see how they relate to space rather than to each other.
Okay, now you're making me think of this art show that I saw recently where Paul Litherland is this artist. He did something called, I'm spacing on the title, but basically they have this thing for training skydivers, which is a humongous fan that sort of keeps you suspended in the air, and that's sort of that same sort of not on the ground, not upright, but just sort of floating.
It's funny you mentioned that, because for about 2 years I was a very serious skydiver.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was too expensive, and I had to give it up. But it was it's amazing to be...
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
It's also about risk. Mm-hmm. When you dive for that ball, or when you decide to throw yourself and your partner into that, you know, not horizontal space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something that pushes you, and you're taking an immense risk. So this feeling of abandon that you elicit from your dancers, but also then by empathy from your audience.
I had someone describe my work as not being about the narrative of a situation, but about the emotion of a situation. And I find in LA a lot of the emotions are frustration, or how we're disconnected, and how do you explain that to people through dance? It can't be, here's a double pirouette and now I'm sad, and here's a jeté and now I'm happy. Those don't convey any meaning to me anymore, those standard kind of ballet idioms. But what you were just saying about risk and abandon, I feel like those are things that I love to do. I love to be out of control but in control, and I think a lot of people feel that way in their lives at times. And so I think it does connect with people in that way. A lot of my audience have used those words, and I've even used them to describe my work, that it's just about letting go and just seeing what happens, and just until you collapse.
Yeah, and control, because martial arts is also about supreme control.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that in-between place is the unpredictability. Like, as a spectator, that's always very exciting. And even as a performer, the unpredictability of being in between and not knowing where, you might land or who might be there. So, it sounds like your work has that sense of, especially the falling and the physicality of it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. There's definitely something to be said for extreme unison and extreme precision. I don't know if you've seen, it's all over YouTube. It's these, it's like Japanese, it's not Japanese, but a lot of Japanese people do it. It's men's rhythmic gymnastics. And they do it in groups of five, and the precision is stunning. Mm. But I really want to see one of them fall. And you never do. You never see them mess up. And when I see a show, I like that it looks like, Ultima Vase, Wim Vandekuypis, like, it looks like they're just making it up right then in the moment. Mm. It looks so organic. And so you can actually feel like something might happen, like something that, and then to watch them respond to it when something does go wrong, how they work their way out of it. So I appreciate that and am drawn to that more than the beautiful unison, although that is very satisfying. But like you were saying, when I'm making work too, that's where I get inspired. I set something on my dancers, I keep pushing them and pushing them and pushing them until one of them drops one of the other or they fall, and that's when they discover something new and I discover something new. And then we kind of build from that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Making an awful lot of sense.
It makes performing a work very exciting too, because every night, because of that aspect, it just makes
Absolutely.
The performers, you can't really go into automatic. You can't, it's very easy in unison or like in something that isn't like that to just be like, oh, okay, I've done this five times. Mm-hmm. But, have you seen one of the Ultima Vez performances where they throw bricks?
Yes, yes.
And they run and they catch it, and it's just like, it's so unpredictable.
They're real bricks.
Yeah, they're real bricks, and sometimes they don't catch it, and sometimes they have to slide, and they have to, it's scary to be like watching and to be in it, but it just makes it so much more exciting every time you perform it.
I like, as an audience member watching that, to know from a dancer's perspective how connected they are on stage, and that it's existing in this own other world that you can't really be a part of. But I definitely love when I'm dancing in my company that every show is completely different. Something always goes wrong in a different place every night. And you never know when that's going to be. And it makes it fun, especially when you work it out with your dancer in the moment to keep going, and create something new. And the audience really never knows those things because it all looks crazy and ridiculous and like a mess, but you do. And so it really bonds our group together. I mean, a lot of my dancers I've had for the entire 5.5 years that I've had my company.
Right.
And so I can't imagine if they ever leave me. It's going to be very sad.
What are you teaching at your master classes here?
I call it method technique. It's just my own yoga-based technique about how to exist in an off-center environment safely. They seem to be thriving on it. They really have enjoyed it this, 2 weeks. A lot of injuries, a lot of floor burns, banged up elbows, but they seem to really enjoy it. I love being in the air or on the ground, and they're very not much, at least these dancers take to it quite well, but aren't used to always being there. And it's been a nice, really nice evolution over the last 2 weeks to be reminded how they looked the first day and how they look today. It's quite a change.
You mentioned yoga.
Mm-hmm. Ashtanga.
Ashtanga? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do you incorporate the yoga with the method?
A lot of the movements actually come from different yoga poses that we then kind of twist or move in space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Vira One, that position? Mm-hmm. It's on one leg, completely turned to the side, like a plus sign, one arm up, out. Like, a lot of movements come directly from that. What happens if we lift that shape and just push it into space, and then someone catches you? Yeah, that's pretty much it. It gives you a sense of control over what you're doing because you're incredibly connected to your body. It also puts everything in the proper alignment, I think. You know, elbows in, shoulders down the back, abdominals engaged. And there's a million different poses. And if you're that flexible and that strong with those poses and you try to lift them up and throw them, cool things happen.
That does sound like a fun class.
It is fun. I mean, people... I have a problem getting them to stop at the end of class. Like, they keep wanting to go, and I'm like, no, I have to go to this interview right now. I can't stay. Like, no, we want to do it again.
It's a good sign.
I'm on a completely different topic. My lips are obviously not following my mouth and my brain right now. But the LA dancing, it's there. I know somebody who's out there, and she's sort of saying that it's not really... Yeah, she does. She thinks that they're dancers and so on, but it's not really a dance scene. How do you find it in comparison to Montreal? And then also, how did you find Montreal?
Okay, first question. I don't really know what community means. I think every community has their own community, and I kind of think it is whatever it is. So we do have an LA dance community, and it's very unique. I think there's a lot of geographic isolation. It's very hard to get around in Los Angeles. So there's no central place for dance. So you don't feel connected to other people in that way. Thankfully through technology, we don't really have to, we can communicate, but we can't actually be together in one space. So you have a lot of individual choreographers working with their own group of dancers completely independently of everyone else. And the only time you ever see other people's work or see them is at another person's show, which you don't go to because it's too far away from where you live. So there's this huge disconnect. And there's also two levels, which I'm sure might be the same in Montreal. There's the uber professional level, which in LA means out of town dance companies being brought in. And then there's this underground dance scene with all the native dancers or local dancers trying to access those funds and get some recognition. There is a huge kind of burgeoning underground dance scene that has developed in the last decade, I'd say, and it's doing lots of really, really interesting work. We're just really struggling right now to how to get recognition for that. And local recognition, because a lot of our companies tour. I'm here in Montreal, but it's a huge struggle financially in LA. And I hear it's the same other places, but it always seems like the grass is greener. Like in Montreal, it just seems like, oh my gosh, there's Circuit Des and there's so many companies and everything must be amazing here. But I hear some of the same complaints that it's very disconnected. Or
I don't find it is that disconnected. It's just, to me, it's so immense.
In LA or here?
Here.
Here.
I've never seen, I think you're the first LA dancer I've ever spoken to.
Oh, really?
Yes. Actually, no, second, because, yeah, there's my friend Kelly who is out there. So, yes, the second one, but I've never seen her perform even on video.
Who does she dance with?
I got to go find out.
Okay. I'd like to know that. But how I got brought to Montreal by my friend Mike Watts, who is a dancer here, and he saw my videos on YouTube about 4 years ago and knew Francine at Circuit Des and said, hey, Bradley should come out and teach. So it was too late in the season for them to actually bring me out, so I just came and taught for a week. But then they asked me to come back this year for 2 weeks and brought me here to teach. So it's opened up a whole new world. Thank you, Michael.
And then do you see any differences between the LA and... you've already answered that, so somebody else should pop in with a question if I'm now repeating stuff that has already been said.
Are you talking about difference between LA dancers or...
Thank you. Yes, is there a difference between LA dancers and Montreal dancers?
Yes, there is. I feel bad saying this, though. It's actually something common I see a lot of places, and it might be just a difference between my dancers and my company and other dancers, but... Since people are so used to standing on their feet all the time, they have really strong, powerful, striking legs and incredibly weak arms.
Interesting observation.
I'm always surprised when I come to teach in a new place and just see how completely disconnected from people's arms they are, that they can't use them in any way like they use their legs. They have these amazing legs that are just so dynamic, and I call them pterodactyl arms or teacups. They start doing something crazy that they haven't done before, and their hands immediately get all gnarled up in front of their body. Or if they're gentlemen, they do teacups where their hands go out like this to the side, like they're carrying teacups on the backs of their hands. And I call it, you know, a habitual problem that they need to get rid of, and they cannot do it. I think it takes a long time to, and a lot of floor work to really reconnect with your arms, because we're just used to using them.
As embellishment.
Right, exactly. Right?
As an extension of your body.
Yeah.
And you're not really, unless you're carrying somebody around, you're not going to use them much, right?
Right. Yeah. So they're just kind of flopping and flapping around. And I like to use them to carve the space and to facilitate movement off center and as a protection mechanism. If you really push yourself off center and slip and fall, you need your arms to get into the floor. And I encourage people to do that. I always say in my class, the first person that falls gets a gold star, because if you don't fall, if you don't slip and fall, you're not pushing yourself far enough. And there is a difference between being risky and reckless. I don't want you to be reckless, but you need to take that risk or you're not going to find anything new. Mm-hmm. You're just going to be dancing the same way you've always danced. So,
now there's a guy here, Greg Selinger, known as Crypto, who's a breakdancer, b-boy, who I'm just always continually astounded. He is as comfortable on his hands, actually probably more comfortable on his hands than he is on his feet.
Yeah.
And which way? How do you do that? That's amazing.
People ask me how I can be in the air so much, and because I often have my dancers throwing me, and I go, I love flying through the air. It that feels more natural to me than just kind of standing around.
I wanted to go back to the LA dance community. Mm-hmm. What are the spectators like? What is the audience like? What's the demographic of people who come to watch a contemporary dance show in LA?
I would say it's a very small, diehard group. There's probably about 5,000 people that go to see everything. 5,000 people that go and see dance, and it's a core group of about 500 that go and see every show. I always see the same people out at every show. Mm-hmm. But we've been really struggling to expand that audience, and it's, I guess maybe the same audience as everywhere. It's friends of the people in the company, people who used to dance but don't anymore. And then a small percentage, maybe 20% of people who actually like contemporary dance and are really into it and don't dance and will go and see it. There's also a big segment of people who buy subscription series to certain theaters, so they go and see a lot of stuff. And that's a big thing in LA. It might be here too. But the audiences love everything, which is strange. No, we call it the standing obligation or the standard ovation.
You'd be amazed at what they applaud here as well.
Oh, yeah.
Standing ovations at everything. And I'm like, I'm sorry, that was horrible. I hate to say that, but and this sounds horrible, but I don't like a lot of dance. I actually went through a crisis a few years ago. I'm like, I don't like going to see dance. I love making it and doing it, but I don't like to see it.
I'm the same. I don't like watching dance sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why. I would rather go see, like, you know, something
maybe
in the gallery or, like,
this is your day job. You need some space in your head for other input.
I'm not sure what it is exactly, but I find a lot of dance that I go to too, I don't enjoy it, or I'm just like,
I feel like I've seen it before.
Yeah.
Or I guess there's two types of dance that I like. Dance that stuff that where the movement invention is such that I've never seen it before. Or even if I don't like the movement invention, the artistic integrity is so intense that I really respect what they made. There is a certain dance company in this town, Montreal, that I used to love. I don't love them so much anymore because I don't really respond to the physicality that they use, but it's so well-crafted that I will go see it no matter what because I love it.
Right. But you don't find inspiration, you know, by browsing around other dance companies?
No, I often, especially in LA, I get depressed sometimes. Because there seems to be a big push also in LA to be really prolific. You have to be making work all the time and putting stuff out there. And I can't do that much work because I feel like it's not good. Well, I never feel it's good. Sometimes it's okay, and then sometimes it's horrible. Those are my two levels. But I think if you're just churning out work all the time, you're not really spending the necessary time in the studio to investigate your own body. What's your own unique way of moving? What's your, you know, unique voice? And, you know, my creative process, I hate these types of words, artistic integrity and creative process, don't confine themselves to a granting schedule. Like, I can't be creative between these two end marks that they've placed for me in order to get my funds and write a report. So I don't really apply for grant funds anymore. But I know everyone else in LA does, so they're churning out work every 6 months. And
they have to.
Because they have to.
And then it's quantity over quality.
Right. Mm. And I hate to be snotty like that. My work's better because I take longer. That's not true. Sometimes it's still horrible, but I think you cannot make work fast good.
Mm. You know, it's one of the things that I find here is that there's an awful lot of stuff that is where it's almost work in progress, and where, well, everybody, there's the humongous hype to go see the world premiere of some local company's show. Mm-hmm. It's, to my mind, actually way better to miss the world premiere, let them go on tour for 3 years, come back and see the final presentation, because by that time, after 3 years, they will have worked out all the kinks, the artistic integrity, the vision, everything will have come together into something that is absolutely amazing. But to watch that whole process or see it from the beginning, it's the sort of thing, yeah, it's like I have a nephew who is now 7 months old. And after about an hour, I've gone through my entire routine of everything I can do with him. And that's it. I'm certain when he's 18 years old, it will be much more than an hour that I can spend with him.
Right.
And it's the same way, to my mind, with a lot of the dance that happens here is that, yeah, it's a good idea, and then let's spend the time making it perfect as opposed to getting it up on stage immediately.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this happens here, but in LA, there's you only get to do it once. Or before a weekend, and that's it. You spend 9 months putting it together, and then it just happens on one weekend. And unless you take it out to another city or find another venue, that's it. It's gone. You're never going to do it again.
It's very similar here, except for the fact that there is a sort of government-instituted sort of set of touring. So there are, you can go from here to Quebec City, to Trois-Rivières, to Drummondville, and so on, and do a weekend in each. And then it's a sort of thing where once that happens, then if you have applied for the right grants, then you can get out to the rest of Canada and so on. But yeah, there's an awful lot of stuff that just gets performed once and then it disappears.
Well, that sort of touring circuit is something that's desperately needed in the United States. I mean, unless you're part of the NDP or something, that at that level, I don't even know how you get to that level currently.
And I think it's a lot of practice.
It's a lot of practice in 30 years, I guess. People keep saying, oh, you... What do you want to have? What kind of company do you want to have? And I describe it to them, and they go, oh, yeah, like, that took 30 years for them to get to that level. I'm like, I want it now. It's been 6 years. I'm exhausted already. I can't keep doing this.
Wait, what's the typical length that you spend on creating a full-length piece?
For an hour, I spend, or for an evening-length work, which is usually an hour to an hour and a half, I spend about 9 months.
9 months?
Yeah.
Okay.
I go really slow. I make a lot of stuff, and I edit out a lot of stuff. I throw away a lot of probably really good stuff.
I'm 9 months full time?
No. We rehearse only actually 3 days a week.
Okay.
And because everyone has a day job or another job, rather. I'm a paralegal by day.
That's actually really great. 9 months is a lot of time to really develop things and see where it goes and allow the dancers to go really deep.
Yeah.
Because often when things are rushed, you know, and like you're like rehearsing 5 times a week, 8 hours a day, 3 months. I mean, it's a lot of hours, but it doesn't have that space to breathe.
I need that
space. That's great, yeah.
I need those days off in between to think about it. And I do try to think about it.
And let your body recover from dislocated ribs and things.
I don't think we could do this every day. I think we'd probably be in wheelchairs rather quickly.
We got to take a break here.
Okay.
It's 2:36. You're listening to Movement Museum, where we talk about dance in Montreal and elsewhere. On your radio, on your mobile device, on your computer, all over the place. CKUT 90.3 FM on one device, movement-museum.blogspot.com on another device. If you want to get in contact with us, movement@ckut.ca, and we will be back momentarily. Movement Museum, opinions and primary voices. In a world increasingly reduced to a who markets louder philosophy that is by definition going to steamroll contemporary dance right out of existence, Movement Museum is an hour-long talk show where all you will hear is honest and compelling opinions. Opinions on why dance matters.
Opinions on why dance.
Opinions on what dance matters.
Opinions on what dance.
We talk to dancers, choreographers, teachers, composers, academics, audience members, producers, presenters, and anyone else with an opinion on dance. What moves them, what do they like, and most importantly, why. Live Thursdays at 2 o'clock Eastern Time on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, archived for all of eternity, Friday mornings at movement-museum.blogspot.com. And we're back. In the background there, this is Anna Weber, which we're off her album Third Floor People. And yeah, in the background, it's been sounding actually rather nice. It's I thought it was a new release, but it's not. It's from 1991. I'll have to go do some research and so on. And we now have Marie-Hélène from Now try saying
bonjour.
Yes, bonjour. Marie-Hélène from Voulez-vous danser avec moi.ca.
Nice to be back.
Yes, thank you very much. You're the one who keeps us on the other side. Well, actually, Bradley is sort of like that as well, because it's one of the things to explain is that how an awful lot of us don't do an awful lot of moving, and Marie-Hélène does moving, but not on a professional thing on a stage. She does all the other dances, the ones that are like the tangos and the salsas and so on, and that to me is a whole that wonderful part of the dance scene as well.
What I'm trying to do actually with my site is to make people aware who don't know already Montreal of all these wonderful venues we have for partner dancing. And the other couple of times I came here, I talked about outdoor dancing. Of course, that's over for this year. We talked about swing dancing that's keeping on more and more with big bands in Montreal that keeps on. But today I'd like to talk about what we call in French danse sociale and what in English is called ballroom. Does anybody here do ballroom?
I used to as a teenager.
No.
They made me. Yes.
So you can explain maybe to us what the difference is between, and it took me a while to understand that, there's different crowds. Some people do ballroom dancing just for fun, like when I go tango dancing. And lots of people, I would say, I think most people who are interested in those dance, do dance sport. Have you done just ballroom or actually gone to competitions?
I stopped just before the competition.
All right.
So as a German teenage girl, you are required when you're 14 to go to dance school and learn all the social dances.
This is so interesting. When you say all?
Tango, foxtrot, waltz, all the social dances. I did that for 2 years, like all my friends.
Wow.
And then, because in Germany what's really popular is, you know, every tennis club, every school, everybody has a ball twice a year. So you own a long dress, and then you go and you dance, and you have to know to be able to dance with the grown-ups. As a teenager, you have to learn how to do all these dances.
Wow.
And I was quite good at it, so I was approaching the level of competition. But when I saw my friends who went into this with the fake eyelashes with the little diamonds on the end, and you know, it became less dancing fun, but dancing like really strange, and also you kind of had to date your dance partner, which was also another issue, I kind of dropped out.
Well, I know what you mean. I've been to a few competitions here in Montreal to see. It's a show, and that's not what I talk about usually. I talk about where you can go dancing, but doing that, I had the same reaction as you. I don't want to go that far. However, it made me realize all the 10 dances you have to learn. And I have a list here, and you tell me if they were the same in Germany.
Uh-huh.
They put them in two groups, standard and Latin dances.
Yes.
So you have waltz, Viennese waltz, tango, which is different from Argentine tango, foxtrot and quickstep. And the Latin dances are cha-cha-cha, rumba, samba, paso doble, and jive. Is that correct?
Perfect.
Okay.
Exactly. That's what I learned.
Yep. See, I don't want to learn all that, and I don't want to compete either. But some of the dances here are interesting, and I know some of my friends sometimes say that. Oh, I would just like to try the quick step. Or I would just like to try, you know, one of them. I found a place for us all. I didn't see the venue yet because it's a new venue, but on the web it looks nice. It's called Espace des Arts. Maybe you've seen it on Sainte Catherine near Saint Laurent. If you go to the side, there's a click to the place and you can check it out. But the school that moved there, I know, and I've been to their activities before, and they just started on Wednesday nights what they call combo evenings. 1 hour of class with 1 hour of dancing for $5. And they teach you just a few steps of one of those 10 dances. So you can check on their website or call them and say, okay, I'd like, when's the Rumba class? I want to try the Rumba. And you go and you try it. And maybe that's it, you'll never try again. Or maybe you will sign up eventually to one of the many ballroom schools here in Montreal. But I found this was a nice concept, a nice way to introduce people to the fact that you can sign up to ballroom classes without competing. There are many nice ballroom dancing venues in Montreal where people just go for fun, even though I must say the vast majority who learn these dances do it in a competitive approach. They want to compete, why not? But both exist here in Montreal, so this is a way to discover it.
I want to know, what's the difference between a waltz and a Viennese waltz?
You would, if you watch them, well, you can explain better than me. Go ahead.
The Viennese waltz has a different speed, and the steps are a little easier. There's more spinning.
But don't you need a lot more room?
You need a lot more room, because otherwise you bump into people because of the speed.
It's beautiful.
And I love it more.
Oh,
it's
and
more
me
fun.
Too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I can come up with lots. It's like quick step, and yeah, it's there given that I don't know any of the dances. It's a sort of thing of really, okay, so I got a vague idea of what a waltz is. I got a vague idea of what a tango is. I've heard of the foxtrot, but way beyond me.
What was this Australian movie? Was it Strictly Ballroom?
Oh, yes. That's a great
Rend
movie.
That. You'll yes. see a bit of them all. It's a very funny movie, too.
Yeah, and actually it is dependent on the music. In the end, the dances that I enjoyed most were more the Latin ones, because the music was much more fun than the kind of umpapa music that they play for the foxtrot. And,
but then again, in some competitions I've been to in Montreal, they have very good DJs, and they even use some of Quebec songs from our to have people at least rehearse on them. So that was a lot of fun. So I never give you all the addresses and prices and dates, because you can find them on the website voulezvousdanceravecmoi.ca. But yeah, that was my little ballroom introduction.
Cool.
Yeah, fantastic.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, $5 was very reasonable.
Oh, yes, and the prof, his name is Sergei, one of the owners of that school. I went to one of his classes, not that particular combo, but something before. He's very good. He has a lot of experience as a dancer and as a teacher. And I know in 1 hour you can teach a little group, a little choreography, you know, so that you have fun and you learn something. It's worth it.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing.
And that probably makes sense why an awful lot of people don't like the floor. I bring this as a nice segue back to Bradley. In terms of, yeah, if that's my introduction to dancing, that's, yeah, I'm standing straight up and I'm not doing anything on the floor there.
And I'm having someone else hold me up and lead me the entire time. I actually took a tango class and I had to lead, and I didn't understand how to make someone follow me. Because in my work, we both go to, you go together. You have to do it together or else it won't work, so...
Now, I've always been taught that I put my hand in the small of their back and I push.
Yeah, and actually as a follower, especially when you're learning, that's really difficult. Because you learn the steps, and then you have to learn to follow somebody who may not know the steps very well. So you end up leading when you should be following. And then
you mean in ballroom?
Yes.
Because in Argentine tango, that doesn't happen. This is why it's so much more fun. There's no steps to learn. It's improv. So you really follow the leader.
I can't. I always have a hard time doing partner dance because I can't let go of control. I'm like, I'm supposed to listen. Okay, hold on. Let go of control now.
As far as the ballroom dancing, I was always fascinated by the line how Ginger Rogers was a better dancer than Fred Astaire because she did all the same steps as he did, but backwards and in heels.
Yep, that's true.
At which point, Dom, any more bad jokes we can do about ballroom dancing?
I can't think of one.
Okay, then how did you end up with a company? Because that's the sort of thing which I can imagine it's either like an albatross around your neck or a lodestone that you're carrying around.
It's oftentimes like that. When I left college, I went right into a dance company in LA called Tongue. It's not sexual, it meant like language. Dance is our language. And it was a great, amazing company. I was with them for 4 years, and right before we were about to make it big, we had gone to APAP in New York twice. We had Mr. Wexler from The Joyce coming to watch us, and we were all very excited we might get asked to come, you know, get an invite to apply. You have to have an invite to apply. And the company director said, I'm done. That's it. I don't want to do this anymore. and it destroyed a lot of us. Some people just stopped dancing completely because we just had given everything to this company for so many years. It had been that was its eighth full year, but I wasn't ready to become a lawyer. It was my backup plan, and now I definitely don't want to become a lawyer. So I just started my own company, but I made that first work that I spoke about earlier after the fracture with my best friend, Jay, who's a member of my company. And just to even see if I could choreograph, I've always had things in my head, these impossible, crazy ideas, but you don't really know if you can get them out of your head through your body into the body of someone else until you try that, and it worked. I was able to do it, and I thought, okay, I'll try this for 2 years, and then it became four, and now it's six, so...
You're going to go till eight?
I'm going to go till eight.
Okay.
I mean, at
30.
Did you ever see Dance Maker, the Paul Taylor documentary?
Not yet.
You should see it. Just for this one part where he says, at the end of every season in those early years, he's like, that's it, I'm done, I can't do this anymore, it's too hard. And then a three-month break occurs, and then he has to get back to doing it. And these last two seasons, that's how I felt. At the end of the season, I'm like, it's too hard, there's not enough money, I'm destroyed, I'm always broke, I'm always tired, and then I don't dance for a week or two, and I'm like, okay, this is what, it's in me, I have to do it. So I don't think I'll ever stop, I just really need to buckle down and get it funded and get it going and find a new way to love it, because being an artistic director isn't a lot different than just being the choreographer or a dancer.
Now, it's one of the things that I'm always struck by, because in doing the show, I'm suddenly learning that there's a whole bunch of history to dance that I never previously was aware of. And then Diaghilev, which I'm butchering his name, but the big thing with him was always, I have no money, I have no money, I have no money. I realize if you're going to be dancing, you're going to be broke. It's pretty much a self-serving sentence or something like that.
What I always say is, even Mikhail Baryshnikov, who is like certainly the best dancer currently living and arguably one of the best ever, still has to do Sex in the City episodes to make ends meet. Like, even if you make it big, you're not going to be a millionaire. That will never happen.
No, that's not why you're in it.
And that's not why
you're in dance?
In dance, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because you were saying earlier that you don't write for grants anymore. How does your company, how do you sustain the company? How does that run work for you?
Through a transfer of funds from my personal bank account to my company's bank account for my day job, from ticket sales, and from certain foundation grants where they're more open-ended. They just give you a chunk of money for a certain project, but they don't require you to write all these numerous reports and demographic studies. In LA, they're very concerned with like demographics and how many, what is the ethnic breakdown of your audience, and I don't know, how would I know those things? How many HIV positive individuals are in your audience? That's one of the
seriously.
That's one of the categories. Like, I'm supposed to poll them after my show.
Oh my god!
So maybe that's what happens during the Q&As.
I guess so. I guess so. Maybe I should start doing them. But
no.
And through donations, I solicit a lot of private donations. Mm-hmm. I have a fundraiser and things like that.
How big is your company?
There's six of us.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, a cast of thousands.
No.
So
I don't know how companies have like 16 dancers. I don't know. That's a lot of personalities in one room. The max I've had is eight, and that was about my limit. Mm.
No, my understanding is that it's a similar hodgepodge, even with the big companies. It's the sort of thing that, the board of directors is the equivalent of the administrative director, and it goes from their pockets into the company's bank account. It's just there are a couple of other steps that make it everybody go home happier, because they're charitable things, and
501c3 and
yes,
states,
that sort of stuff, and it makes it a little bit easier for the money to pass through everybody.
Right,
but it's dance is not a money making venture in any stretch of the imagination.
Now, for a lot of corporations in the United States, you get paid to be on the board of directors, whereas in at least the dance world, you have to pay.
Yeah, in the arts world, even the visual arts sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know in some of the major museums, you have to pay to be on the board.
Yeah. And I've really been working hard to pay my dancers. I mean, I still don't pay them anywhere near what I think they're worth, but everyone else gets paid first. Mm-hmm. You know, the lighting designer, the union house, the tech people, the music. If you license music,
right.
The presenter, the venue, everyone. And dancers just expect not to get paid, and I think that's horrible. They should expect to get paid.
This is the thing I always ask, is are we just perpetuating this idea that dancers dance it's just, we're not going to make money, you're going to be poor, you're going to be working a side job, because for me, I'm a dancer and I don't want to be poor. So are we perpetuating that idea, and then are we, you know, taking that away from ourselves as dancers and just accepting that, okay, I'm not going to be paid as much and I need to work a side job? Like, how much of that reality are we creating ourselves? You know what I mean?
I completely agree with you. We are creating that reality. I've been in little forums where they say, what is, you know, like I was talking about earlier, what is the goal of your company, or how do you see it in 5 years? I go, well, I want to make this amount of money and I want my dancers to make this amount. And people are laughed and like, do that. They're dancers. They can't make that much money. And go, well, why can't they have a living wage?
Yeah.
And these are other dancers and choreographers saying these things. And I think it's a badge of honor that we suffer for our art. Mm-hmm. And there should be some suffering, but I think it's kind of built into dancing that you're going to suffer physically.
Yeah, as your feet.
You shouldn't have to suffer financially. And I think it shortens a lot of people's careers. And I think a lot of really talented people get out of dance because it's just not doable. If you want to have a family, or you want to have... go on vacation. Like, I've taken 2 vacations in almost 7 years. That's it.
Yeah.
I don't consider this a vacation coming to Montreal.
You need a larger audience. I mean, you know, I'm stunned that in LA, which is massive, you have 500 people going around from show to show.
Like, they're here. I've heard numbers, because the government is the one that does the polling. They've said that there's an audience of 7,000 people who do dance in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine then that 1/10 is sort of the 700 who go around to every damn show. Actually, it can't be, because you have a place like Tangente or Agora de la Danse, which Tangente wouldn't seat 700 people even if you played there an entire week. And so I would imagine you probably have the 7,000 who go to the Place des Arts shows and the out-of-town touring things, and then maybe a core group of 300, 400 who see everything.
Yeah, but that's Montreal. We're like, what, 3 million?
Yeah, and then, so just as far as comparison to L.A. and Bradley's figures on L.A.
I would say, yes, those figures do apply to L.A., and even though it's a much larger megapolis there, complicated geography probably prevents that. People in Orange County or Ventura County, which are the adjacent counties to LA County, are not going to come into LA County to see a local dance show. They might come to see La 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 if they come to LA, to Royce Hall at UCLA. Mm. But those people, and particularly the ones that go to those big venues in LA, do not go to the local dance shows. They just, part of it is the quality, I'm sure, and a lot of it also has to do with the socioeconomics of it. They like to go out to a fancy dinner to see, you know, an amazing show from an out-of-town dance company, but they don't want to do the local work. They don't understand that those out-of-town dance companies come to our city because the cities they came from invested in them 20 years ago.
Yeah, there's a grassroots. Exactly. Do you have, like, neighborhood theaters and neighborhood venues, they're like the local watering hole for each, because I used to live in London and it was like that for theater. You know, not everybody went to, you know, the National Theater, because, you know, also in London it takes an hour and a half to go from one, you know, neighborhood to the other. But you had your neighborhood theaters, you know, the theater above the pub, and that was where everybody met of that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Do you have that for dance in LA?
It's not quite that people meet there from the local neighborhood, but each neighborhood has, we call them 99-cent theaters, because they're 99 seats, and tickets are very cheap. And that's where pretty much we all do our shows, in those types of theaters, and they're of varying sizes. But people will go to those shows, but they're not, I'm sorry, I forgot actually what the question was.
So will that sustain your local smaller dance troupes?
No, because even with those small theaters, we're still not able to do multi-week runs of shows. Mm. That, not because the audience won't be there, but because financially it's not going to be sustainable to rent a theater for 5 weeks. It's just not possible.
Rents in LA, I guess.
Extremely high. Mm.
The amount of revenue you make from seats, theater seats, compared to the expenses that go into making a dance, paying all the artists, renting the theaters, renting the technicians, it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Insurance.
Yeah, and insurance. I mean, you can spend $25,000 producing a show, and you might make in revenue, depending on the seats, maybe like $3,000-$4,000, depending on the ticket sales too. But in terms of comparison, so it's so hard for companies to exist without funding sometimes. but it's hard. It's a hard, you know, world to be in.
Yeah. I'm surprised, you know, are those figures for here or for LA? Because
that's exactly I produced a show in Calgary. I've produced a few shows also for the Montreal Fringe, and that's the reality of it. Yeah. It's like we sold out a few shows in Calgary, and we were selling tickets $15-$20, which is, you know, it's not like cheap, but it's not super expensive. And that's basically the numbers. So what do you do?
although we're running out of time here, one thing to be might be also just to do an experiment and say, okay, as opposed to pricing the company at what you think is a reasonable price that will get people in, to actually say, no, we're actually looking for the Rolex crowd and the Ferrari crowd, so let's price the tickets at $150 a pop and see what happens. And worst comes to worse, you're no worse off than you were before, but potentially there is a humongous payday. And if everybody thinks, oh my God, they're charging $150 a ticket, they're going to be amazing. That's the most hottest show I've ever heard of before.
I'm stealing that. That's yet another idea I'm stealing from you. Thank you.
No problem there. They're tossed out there for free for everybody. And if they work, spread them around even more.
I will.
At which point, it's 3 o'clock. Bradley Michaud, thank you very, very
much. Bradley.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jen, Marie-Hélène, Bettina, thank you all very much for making me look and sound better than I have any right to. And without you guys, I couldn't be. I gotta figure out a we in there. And now again, my lips are running away with my mouth. This has been Movement Museum. My name is Zeke. I've been here with Jen, Marie-Hélène, and Bettina. We will be back next week at the same time, same channel, and see you then.